All right. Thank you, Rabbi Emerson. I appreciate hosting the history share. I'm sorry that I backed up two. I've been doing these back up two in a row. It's a little taxing on the Olam to do it in the schedule, but the summer's hitting us, and I want to be able to end the series before the summer's over, before we get to the summer. All right, the story tonight is the story of Rambam, of Yula, of the Wiesenthal Center. And we left off talking about Shari Tfila. We talked about some of the shtibluch on the other side of town. These little shuls that would pop up that had figures that were, in some sense, to the people living then, larger than life figures here in Los Angeles. We talked about the life of some of the major philanthropists and donors who built the area. And I want to now move over to another individual. 1959. A young fellow comes from Allentown, Pennsylvania, originally a Czechoslovakian near Munkacs, and he starts a yeshiva katana in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And after 5 years, they decide to move to a position in Los Angeles at a place called Los Angeles Hebrew Junior High. Los Angeles Hebrew Junior High. They were placed there by Torah Mesorah. The name of this individual, his name was Rabbi Jacob Friedman. And he took the position over there, and later Los Angeles Hebrew Junior High is going to become Rambam, which is ultimately going to become Yula, which is going to become Yola, which is going to go back to becoming Gula. And we're going to get to that evolution. But it starts with Los Angeles. I bet you most people who go to Yula or have even worked in Yula do not know that the original name, that the original birth of this idea was Los Angeles Hebrew Junior High. It was a Orthodox institution run by the modern Orthodox rabbis here in LA, Rabbi Dolgin, Rabbi Levine, Rabbi Spiegelman. Together, they ran or they developed the initial concept. A couple years were added onto the junior high, fully forming a high school and thus giving it the name Rambam. One of the great professors at the school, who we're going to talk about as well tonight, was the great Rabbi Grumman, was teaching at this institution as well, came at a young age. And Rabbi Friedman's tenure there was not long. It's interesting. At the same time, just to get context, in the Torah Semes history, Torah Semes is beginning its movement as well then. You have Rabbi Tesler is there. Some people know the name Rabbi Tesler. Another one from Rabbi Tesler's generation was someone brought out by Rabbi Friedman, brought here to LA as a mechanech, who stayed in Techinuch for a little while here in Los Angeles, Rabbi Chmenitsky. Was here in Los Angeles. He was greeted at the airport as the big superstar mechanech as he was coming out here to Los Angeles. Rambam was a struggle, and it was partially a struggle from the beginning because it did not have a specific shul affiliation. Yavna had its Shaar Tfila, Hillel had its Beth Jacob, but the problem was that Rambam did not have its go-to shul, because the shul was the Balabatim. And in some senses, that's flipped a little bit nowadays. The school boards are very much, in most communities, a lot of the places where many of the influential machers are in our generation, sometimes even more than the shuls. A lot of the energy has now been focused behind the schools. That wasn't the case at that period of time, certainly in Los Angeles. The machers were involved in the shul, not in the school. Because again, what was happening then? The people involved in schools back then were very young. You couldn't make money yet. Now the trend is that the young are the entrepreneurs, and they are making the money. So the young parents who are involved in schools are the ones who do have money to make a difference. But back then, the young parents who were involved in schools were dependent on those that were the machers in the shuls. And Rambam had no shul affiliation. Because of that, it struggled at its inception. It struggled at the beginning. Rabbi Jacob Friedman soon in found that it was not for him. This role was not cut out for him. And you know, some things, we looked at a few examples of this in the history of Los Angeles, and it's true in life. Some failures are actually when they don't work out in one context, another door opens, and for Rabbi Friedman, a whole other world opened for him, and leads a very successful life in a business end here in Los Angeles, and as a philanthropist here in Los Angeles, which if everything would have worked out at Rambam, a lot of institutions would not have benefited from Rabbi Friedman's generosity. A lot of cities in Israel, and yeshivot in Israel, would not have benefited for Rabbi Friedman's generosity and his family's generosity. So it's interesting how that works. Sometimes when you think something is, a door that Nebuch closed, it often it opens up, HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens up another door for you. But that left a vacuum here in the Rambam institution, and it will be a vacuum for a little while of new leadership trying to make the school work. But one individual who's certainly going to be forever associated with his years in Rambam is Rabbi Grumman. And when we talk about celebrities in the history of Orthodox Los Angeles, one of those celebrities is Rabbi Grumman, if not the most celebrated, the top 10 most celebrated figures. If we do the movie, The History of Orthodox Los Angeles, we're going to need to make sure one of our lead roles is cast for Rabbi Grumman. He was born in Russia, lived in Ukraine. His father did very well for himself in Russia under the NEP. NEP was Lenin's new economic policy, where even though communist ideas were beginning to grow in burgeon, there was an agreement that we would not reallocate the money from the farmers as long as you paid a tax to the government. Stalin would soon put an end to that. He would take everything from the farmers and destroy the peasant economy entirely in Russia. But for a while, Lenin had an idea where we'll let you farmers make your money, but just pay us a handsome tax. And Rabbi Grumman's father did very well. A couple years after that was initiated, in the pre-Stalin era, right before Stalin came to power, they eliminated the entire job force. It was really being disbanded. Farms were given tractors, property of the government to make entire production for the government, and that meant the end of any profit on the farms. Because of that, they saw the writing on the wall and said, we need to get out, we need to leave this place, we need to leave, because, you know, as we always talk about what Hitler was able to achieve, and we seldom talk about Stalin's hatred for the Jew. Stalin only hated, more than the Jew, the Stalin hated the Polish. After the Poles came the Jews, and third was the Armenians. But the Jews held a very favorite spot in Stalin's heart, which makes the question even bigger, why he voted for Zionism in 1948, which makes the kasha even bigger. But the end of his life, he finished off nice, hating Jews once again. His most anti-Semitic years were at the end. And the Grumman said, we got to get out of here. He comes to America from Russia. How his father buys a Polish citizen's passport. And from Poland, they take a local bus to Czechoslovakia, then on to France, and arrive in Lakewood. Rabbi Grumman arrives in Lakewood. There is an individual who's one of our great figures in LA who we have spoken about, and that's Rabbi Uri. Rabbi Uri was recruiting for Mechanchim here in Los Angeles. Rabbi Uri turned to Rabbi, he met this Rabbi Grumman in Lakewood and suggested that he takes a job out in Los Angeles at Rambam. It's going to be challenging. The place is a little bit of a mess. There's no Gemara. The classes are mixed. There's a lot of work to be done. So after learning for 6 years in Lakewood, he's going to come to Los Angeles. As we said, there were great figures at the time in Los Angeles, but Rambam as an institution was still missing something. And the concept of Rambam was to be a modern Orthodox high school here in Los Angeles, and that did not exist. That did not exist. Just understand, Rabbi Grumman comes with a pedigree as well. Rabbi Grumman is a great-great-grandson of the Shpola Zayda. The Shpola Zayda is one of the greatest Hasidic rebbes in history, was the Bar Plukta of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. The famous Hop Kazak dance is from the Shpola Zayda. And every year, the Rabbi Grumman does a Yortzeit Shola Shudis in honor of the Shpola Zayda. I think it's the only commemorative Shpola Zayda Shalosh Shudis left, and it's run by Rabbi Grumman. Rabbi Grumman introduces Gemara at Rambam, and it takes off right away. The idea of teaching high school kids serious Gemara. He offered a class, a volunteer class, on Sunday. Everybody came. You have to understand, the culture then for learners in Los Angeles, they were starved. They didn't have this. They didn't have all the options that we have nowadays, night classes and shiurim. They didn't have this back then. And whenever it was being offered, now there was finally a clientele who wanted it. We're talking right now, beginning of the 1960s. They turned to the BJE to fund Rambam, to help Rambam fund. Rabbi Uri helps secure the money for to be able to pay for the extra hours, and Sunday becomes a full-fledged regular day of learning. Torah Semes follows Rambam's lead on a Sunday of learning. Rambam is going to have a huge impact in Los Angeles, and I'll tell you why. We spoke last night a lot about the affiliated Jews who had left much of their observance behind in Eastern Europe. They left that world behind, but they liked coming to shul. It was a chance to get together, to talk politics, to be involved in Jewish life. But observance had really fallen by the wayside. What Rambam did was it worked backwards. It says, let's start with the children, and it'll have an effect backwards where the parents begin to become more observant once again. I'm not going to mention individual names in the community, but there are numerous examples of people who sent their kids to Rambam, and because of it, they reclaimed much of the observance that they had in their youth. Whether it was keeping Shabbos once again, the Hakpada of Kashrus in the home was held on to once again, and there was growth. The Shirim got more intense, and they began to start separating the classes. The president at the time was someone we mentioned from the Valley, Earl Korchak, President Earl Korchak, Beth Jacob life as well. President Earl, whose son, by the way, I told you, was the one who opened his home, right? One of the most, I think, one of the highlight moments in Los Angeles history was when we said Earl Korchak opened his home to be able to host one of the prospects for the new rabbi after Rabbi Abner Weiss. I mean, before Rabbi Abner Weiss, we said he opened his home, and that candidate was Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Sachs. So we see Korchak has come back in three contexts now. One of the founders of Shaarei Tzedek, the one who opened his home for the Prabha that brought in Rabbi Jonathan Sachs for the future Rabbi of Beth Jacob, and they didn't want him as the Rabbi of Beth Jacob, and in this context as well. Earl Korchak offers Rabbi Grumman the principal job, and Rabbi Grumman said only if there's going to be a separate school for the boys and the girls. Separate school for the boys and the girls. Mr. Marcus Lowy, another important name to remember for the history of Los Angeles. Mr. Marcus Lowy buys a building on Pico and Swall, which was sold by B'nai David. That's going to be the school for the boys. The girls were going to be housed at Temple Emmanuel. Eventually, Rambam is going to be phased out to YU. We're going to get to elaborate about that. Why? Why Rambam closed its doors to YU? Ultimately, the concept was, and the idea is that the economic viability of sustaining itself would not have been, it was a model that simply wasn't working. It wasn't working. And to sell the organization called Rambam to a bigger organization would allow it to exist in some shape or form. But let's talk about some of the years that Rambam was in its heyday. One of the main machers in Rambam, I'll leave out their name just for the sake of the story, one of the machers who was marginally involved in Rambam but gave a lot of money, so turned and they asked him to be an honoree at one of the dinners of Rambam, and he had a daughter, and she turned 16, and at her sweet 16, they invited all the boys of the 11th grade to the sweet 16. And it was going to be, of course, mixed dancing, a great party, why not? Rabbi Grumman came about it, he heard, and he came to the class the next day. And he said, I heard all the boys here are invited to the sweet 16 party this Saturday night. He said, okay. He opened up his Shulchan Aruch, Evin Ezer, opened up the Simen Chaf Aleph, which is about Kirav Basar, Machlokis, whether it's Deraisa or Derabonan. He went through the Sugya. He says, okay, I'm going to call 11 names from my roster. I want you to come up and rip out a page and tear it out from the Shulchan Aruch and put it in the garbage. Pull the garbage next to the desk. Says, come, before you go to the party tomorrow night, 2 nights from now, I want you to rip out a page from the Shulchan Aruch, throw it in the garbage. Then you can go to the party. You have my bracha. And everyone sat there quiet. They got the message. Nobody went to the party. There was an emergency board meeting 2 days after the party. This macher said, I am not giving money anymore to the school. I am leaving in my position on the board unless you fire Rabbi Grumman. Now, Mr. Marcus Lowy was very close to Rabbi Grumman, and he was also very close to this honoree. So this board member realized that I'm only going to get this done one way. How? Mr. Marcus Lowy's in Israel right now on a trip. He's there. We're going to do this emergency board meeting now. They agree that they're going to fire Rabbi Grumman. They're going to fire him. He was devastated. He said, Rabbi Grumman, I asked him about this episode when it happened. He said very candidly he was devastated. He saw himself as Mr. Rambam, and he was devastated. He says, I didn't leave my house. I couldn't leave. I didn't walk out. So this, best to our knowledge, was 1966. I'm going to double verify. We'll double check that. Rabbi Grumman thought it was 1966. I never verified outside of Rabbi Grumman about that, but we could double check whether that year makes sense. Now, they did the vote when Mr. Lowy, Marcus Lowy, was out of town. He comes back from vacation, expecting to see Rabbi Grumman in his office. Of course, there was no internet. He didn't get to check his email while he was there in Haifa. He comes back and he hears what happened. So Marcus Lowy stands in front of the board and sends a letter, said, I'm resigning from the school, unless Rabbi Grumman is rehired. Rabbi Grumman is rehired from the school, but it begins a series of events where there's this constant infighting within the walls of Rambam, which creates a lot of friction between the leadership, the board, some of the philanthropists, and it creates a very funny situation. When Yeshiva University takes over Rambam many years later, Rabbi Grumman would approach Rabbi Meiselman to discuss whether or not Rabbi Grumman would still stay on in the new iteration of YU/Rambam. And Rabbi Meiselman turns to Rabbi Grumman and says, the problem is if you stay on afterwards, if you still stay on, people will still see this as a continuation of Rambam, and this needs to be an entire rebooting of YU. And at that moment, Rabbi Grumman sees and understands he's not wanted in the new school, and he continues on to teach in Beis Yaakov and play other roles in the community. Just to round out the discussion about Rabbi Grumman, although many years... Yes.
Can you recap a little bit? I'm so sorry, I missed it.
No problem. We're talking about Rambam.
This is part of my...
This is your history. Okay. Okay, I hear you. I hear you.
Just a few minutes.
I'll give you the nutshell.
Okay.
Rambam. We're talking about the school Rambam. You remember the school Rambam?
Of course.
So we're talking about the school Rambam, and Rabbi Grumman was identified with Rambam.
Right.
Rabbi Grumman was Rambam. We talked about the difficult situations facing Rabbi Grumman when he was here in Rambam. It was not easy. We talked about Rabbi Jacob Friedman. I don't know if you know him. He was here initially a principal at Rambam. And we talked about the Rabbi Grumman after a while was sort of when it became a Yeshiva University school. Rabbi Grumman had to step aside. What else did Rabbi Grumman do? Rabbi Grumman was a Rosh Yeshiva of a small project here in L.A. that not too many people remembered existed. It was a Bnei Akiva project. It was a Bnei Akiva yeshiva running concurrently at the same time as Rambam. It was a very flexible operation, late afternoon, early evening. It existed for 4 to 6 years, different opinions as to how long it existed. Some people who spend some time there, if you want to find out more about it, you can speak to Alan Kandel, Kerr Myers. They're those who... What? Ernie Agatstein as well. It existed for a short period of time, and Rabbi Grumman saw that as a place where he could continue giving shirim to some of the boys he connected to in Rambam. He spent some time in Rabbi Wasserman's yeshiva. Many of the people that were here in Los Angeles, we spoke plenty about Rabbi Wasserman's yeshiva. They attempted a role in Rabbi Wasserman's yeshiva, but it didn't, it didn't pan. For many of them, it didn't pan out. Rabbi Wasserman had his way of his mahalach, and it was his way or the highway. So there's sort of a bifurcation. When you speak to people about the person Rabbi Wasserman, he is loved completely and adored. When you speak to people about working in Rabbi Wasserman's orbit, that was a very different, very difficult situation. And because Rabbi Wasserman had a specific way he wanted it to run. I just want to note, just to correct on one of the tapes, we talked about how Rabbi Wasserman didn't want to sell to Chafetz Chaim, why he chose Chabad. There's a lot of controversy, why Chabad over Chafetz Chaim. So the theory I gave, which comes from Dr. David Fox's biography of Wasserman, is because he didn't want to continue the Chafetz Chaim model of Torah learning in his yeshiva. Rabbi Summers affiliated with the Chafetz Chaim. Rabbi Summers says that was not the story. It was just a matter of economics and the sale not going through and Chafetz Chaim not ready yet to come. They wanted to go to the valley. It was an economic issue. It wasn't that Rabbi Wasserman had a problem with the style. He was giving over the style entirely. He was giving over to Chabad. He knew his style was going to be leaving. And that was different. So we need to clarify what exactly, why Chabad was chosen specifically in the sale. But it could just come down to dollars and cents. Yes. The official and full, the full evolution, it's a gradual. There's a full evolution even after 1973. It's still Rambam by 1973. It's still Rambam. We think it's fully YU, 1978, it's fully YU. There was a gradual sale, fully YU by 1978, yeah.
So YU existed prior to that at the same time?
Yeshiva University exists already since 1894. But in Los Angeles, Yeshiva University coming to Los Angeles was a new enterprise. They had made numerous attempts. I didn't mention this in the Shartz Village here. There were numerous attempts to put a property here, to have a YU flagship institution here on the West Coast. Many attempts. Shartz Villa, for example. One of the interim rabbis at Shartz Villa was... Wow, we skipped so much in the Shartz Villa history. I didn't mention all the different rabbis. I got to do a whole thing on Rabbi Jackson Kokon. Maybe the Erev. When we get to the Erev, we can talk about it. There was some Rabbi Shulman. There were some great figures that after Rabbi Spiegelman, who we never got to yesterday. There's so much. This, whatever. Anyways, the Shartz Villa piece is that one of the interim rabbis before Rabbi Shulman, Rabbi Stitzkin, Rabbi Leon Stitzkin came in from Yeshiva University. He was a philosophy professor at YU. So YU said, we'll help you out in the interim to Shartz Villa. So we'll help you out in the interim often means that if it doesn't work out for you, we'll just take over. And that didn't work out for anybody on all sides. There was a lot of friction. You could speak to Mr. Sanford Deutsch was involved in trying to broker whether it's going to be a YU shul or stay Shartz Villa, which is another piece to the checklist of Shartz Villa being crisscrossed between a loss of identity. Are they YU or are they Shartz Villa? And YU buys a separate, they're bought out after they're already bought into the shul. They're bought out and they take a separate property, I think on Melrose, where Rabbi Stitzkin continues a little bit and they bring out some educators, but it doesn't last at all. And YU is gone from LA until you get to 1978 and Yula begins to take shape. But they're going to leave again, YU, and it just, it's not going to work fully for YU here on the, in the YU has historically had a difficult time establishing flagships outside of Washington Heights. Richard Joel's mantra for many years was to make YU a, to bring YU out of Washington Heights and into the American communities. And YU's had a struggle, a challenge with that. And LA is a good example of where that was a challenge. Fine. Rabbi Grumman's story, though, isn't should not be limited to Rambam nor this Bnei Akiva school. Rabbi Grumman spent extensive time building up the kashrus here in L.A., one of the original members of the RCC here in Los Angeles. We'll get to that in our RCC shiur. Moreover, Rabbi Grumman is one of the legendary rabbis of Young Israel of Melrose. Young Israel of Melrose, in its heyday, would be under Rabbi Grumman's leadership. Imagine, he came, a tall, good-looking rabbi, long beard, coming there to this shul. It was a major attraction for people. As I said last night, there were numerous great rabbis, Young Israel Melrose. I failed to mention one last night. After Rabbi Bloom, sorry, there was a Rabbi Bloom, who I passed in another shir. A lot of these crisscross. Rabbi Bloom was a chief rabbi in Argentina. He was also a rabbi for a short time in the Young Israel of Melrose. So you had Rabbi Williger, Rabbi Swift, Rabbi Bloom, and you had Rabbi Grumman. Who's now the rabbi of Young Israel Melrose? Trivia question. Who knows?
Rabbanowitz.
Rabbi Rabbanowitz also. Who was the rabbi before Rabbi Rabbanowitz, Young Israel Melrose?
Rabbi
Adlerstein? Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein? That's a good trivia question. I think he was for a little bit.
Rabbi
Howard Landau?
No.
Rabbi
Hexter. Rabbi Hexter, maybe. All right. We have to figure out. So the, fine, so let's go back. Rabbi Grumman has a, no one knows, Rabbi Grumman has a doctorate in philosophy from Claremont. What's his thesis on? Rabbi Grumman's thesis, one of the most unique theses in the world. Rabbi Grumman's thesis is on the Maharal and the Rambam. Two Torah cosmology. You can look it up online and see Rabbi Grumman's theory. Rabbi Grumman is one of the world's authorities on the Maharal. And still, I think in our present-day Los Angeles, he's still one of the most underutilized resources here in Los Angeles. To have a world authority on the Maharal is a significant notion. And Rabbi Grumman currently also serves as a part-time rabbi at the Eish Tamid Shul. The Eish Tamid Shul is important to mention also for the history of Orthodox Los Angeles. And now I'm skipping ahead to literally 2000 or 1996 to 2000. What you have in Los Angeles is, and this ties into Yula, we're back tying back into Yula, is that you're going to have some, in any community, you're going to have a drop-off in high school children. And what that means is, when you went off the derech, so to speak, in the 50s and the 60s, it meant you left your Judaism behind. In Los Angeles, when you went off the derech in the 1990s, 1980s, 1990s, it meant something else entirely. It didn't mean you necessarily chucked it all and found a fulfilling life as a secular doctor living in Palo Alto. It meant you were lost. And you have an entire, you have a generation that's called, I would label as the lost generation here in Los Angeles. You know, grades of the years that I went to EULA, many of our peers, many of those who couldn't find themselves lost, because those that were successful at EULA and other schools went on to become prominent figures in the Los Angeles community. But what about those who couldn't find their footing academically? They sort of got lost in between. A shul that was open to respond to the needs of those lost souls here in Los Angeles, those kids who didn't have another place to go or a shul that spoke to them, was this Eish Tamid shul that was started by Rabbi Avi Leibovich, who's also a lawyer here in Los Angeles. And its success was interesting as it ties now to our Chassidish Shir, because the Chazan there is going to be Rabbi Lowe, whose comeback is going to be as Chazan in Rabbi Leibovich's Eish Tamid Shul, which is going to occupy some space connecting to last night's year in our Shartfila. It occupies some space in Shartfila and pick up its own house, and now tie into tonight's class, because Rabbi Grumman is the current rabbinic leader at Eish Tamid. As the rabbi of Eish Tamid, Rabbi Leibovich ends up moving to become the rabbi of Andrew Friedman's shul, based Naftali, next to Young Israel, which is its own separate history. So a lot of moving around and moving parts here in Los Angeles. Rabbi Grumman, there is a famous episode for Rabbi Grumman here. We need a whole hour of Rabbi Grumman tonight. There's a famous episode for Rabbi Grumman here. It's one of my favorite stories in the history of Los Angeles. I'm going to leave out names, not to incriminate everybody, just mentioning Rabbi Grumman. Rabbi Grumman walks into the shul one Shabbos morning to notice that the cholent crockpot was switched from high to low. It was tampered with. According to other versions of the story, the plug was re-put in. It's an important difference in the story, because we're talking deraisa, derabanan, who can get hana from the cholent, who's entitled. There's a lot of issues that are affected by here. Rabbi Grumman gets up after shul and says, "We are not going to be eating from this cholent. There was an isser done with the cholent. No one is eating the cholent." A few versions as to what ensued next. And the most radical version of the story, which I don't think is true, but I love it for the movie we're going to use it, is that somebody took the top of the crock pot and threw it to the front of the shul to make a protest. And Rabbi Grumman at that point was done being the rabbi at Beis Naftali, and at that shul. And Rabbi Grumman would focus his energies now and Beis Yaakov, and ultimately as the rabbi in Eish Tamid. And here in Los Angeles, really an iconic figure here in Los Angeles, and we have to appreciate that he started kashrus here in LA. He really, in all intents and purposes, the kashrus as we know it, was started in many ways by Rabbi Grumman. Okay, there were many great figures who had walked through the doors at Rambam, which would later become EULA. Important, you can't go through the names of every student who went there, but I think one person in particular is important to mention, just for the sake of history in Los Angeles, and that is Dr. Rabbi Ernie Agatstein. Why do I mention him? Thousands of people in LA. I mentioned him of all people. He got smicha. This year he got smicha. Yeah. He got smicha and really was the epitome of a rarity here in Los Angeles to show that someone could be, so to speak, homegrown here in LA. One of the last relics of Boyle Heights, right? One of the last children born in Boyle Heights, or the Orthodox Boyle Heights, is Ernie Axe. I don't know who officially is the last Orthodox baby to be born in Boyle Heights, but Ernie Agatstein is one of the last, and never went off to a yeshiva that we know of, or being trained yeshiva, but rather gives one of the most popular dafyomis here in Los Angeles for many years. He's already, I think, made his third dafyomi cycle, see him over here in Los Angeles, and is a very unique figure, certainly for the Los Angeles community, for us to acknowledge him. He was a Rambam from 1969 to 1973. At the same time, the Denver yeshiva opened up, and that pulled away some of those who might have gone to Rambam. Individuals, let's say you might know someone like Saul Major from my side of town, or Bob Rechnitz from my side of town. These individuals decided to go to Denver yeshiva for a year. These little side things that open up in other cities impact LA in a funny way, and they go ahead and impact LA incidentally. In response to that, why am I telling you about Denver yeshiva? Because in response to that, Rambam is going to open up a yeshiva program. The yeshiva program within Rambam becomes, I guess, the first attempt at an AGT, an advanced Gemara track, here for a high school in Los Angeles, which EULA would attempt later on. We'll get to that in a moment, if we do get to that. Okay, let's continue. Torah Semis graduates, many of them went to Tel's Yeshiva, Torah Vidas, Baltimore, They spread out into different yeshivas. LA is not keeping its serious high school learners, and that's why Rambam is also filling a very important need, as Rabbi Wasserman's yeshiva attempted to do as well. The advanced Gemara track had a very funny balance. Those children who were in the advanced Gemara track did not want to be cut off socially, so they played a very important role in the leadership of and the growth of Bnei Akiva here in Los Angeles. And in that sense, Bnei Akiva in Los Angeles had a very unique religious flavor because it was influenced by this Frum crowd who were in the advanced Gemara track in Rambam, also playing a leadership role in Bnei Akiva. The program wasn't too exciting in Denver that many of those individuals came back to Los Angeles to rejoin up for Rambam a couple years later. The yeshiva at Rambam was getting very serious. You'll see, Yula went through a couple years where I would say kids were without labels. But kids were getting very intense. You'll see that. Kids were coming out very intense. And that was happening at Rambam as well. There were a couple years. The 12th grade Rebbe was a very yeshivish Rebbe whose name was Rav Spurka from Detroit. Learned in Ponovich. Rabbi Schreiber, I believe, was a student of Rabbi Spurka. Rabbi Schreiber here at EULA. You had a pressure for the 11th and 12th graders not to be involved in Bnei Akiva anymore. Just to give you, show you the identity of why it was important, that why you stepped in when it did, to retain the modern Orthodox flavor of a high school here in Los Angeles. People felt that Rambam prepped them well for a secular studies. There were programs in UCLA. You wanted the dream in LA was to raise a Frum kid who would go on to UCLA. That was the Jewish dream. And you knew that if you sent them to Rambam, you have a chance. You have a shot at that for your child. And that was exciting for people. Rambam had days literally when the lights were shut off and they couldn't pay the bills. And that was already a sign that why you needed to take over. Let's continue. I want to sidestep now for a different story, and that's how now we're going to come back to EULA. Got to follow my time here. Okay, we can do it. This individual who I'm going to mention next went to RJJ Yeshiva at a time where Nissen Telushkin was the Bocha Nissen Telushkin, the father of Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, just authored a book on the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the way it worked in RJJ is when you were learning Chulin and Yoredeya, Smicha, you moved to a more private base medrash. And there you were under the tutelage of one of the great Gaonim to land in American soil, Rav Yankala Sassel. He was 5'1", hunchback, very little fellow. And he ran a base medrash across from RJJ. He's called the Vishka Eloy, if you look in history, the Vishka Eloy. He was one of the top three in Slobodka, one of those who was able to do the pin test, Now, he loved having sugar in his tea, was famous for his sugar, and the Gaba used to always put his sugar high up, out of reach, and he used to have his students bring him sugar. It was known as the schus of the sugar. Who would bring him the sugar? One of those who used to love bringing him his sugar every day. And this is how Ashkacha Protus works out. It's very funny how history works out. Because one individual loved bringing this Eloy his sugar, that individual's name was Marvin. He loved bringing this Eloy his sugar. Because of that, he spent an inordinate amount of time in that base medrash where RJJ students might be, but often would not be. He made that his main place because he was the go-to sugar guy for the Eloy and saw it as a schus. One day when he had it on his schedule to make sure to be back in the base medrash so he could bring the sugar for the Rebbe, at that moment in the base medrash, a person walks in. And just to backtrack, I want you to understand something. Just to set the stage, a guy walked in once, this we know from the Birka Shmuel, and the YU library. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. Guy walks into the base medrash and goes up to Rav Yankala Sassel and asks him a shaila. Rav Yankala Sassel says, come back to me in a couple days. A couple days later, he has 80 pages. Those 80 pages of an answer are now sitting in the YU library. You're talking about a tremendous goan, and it was a schus. And we talk tongue in cheek that he brought him the sugar of Rav Yankala Sassel. He was a major. He was a major goan. So,
about what year was that?
I don't have the year. Okay. We got to get the year. while he's there bringing him the sugar, Rabbi Haier, Marvin, walks in to bring him the sugar. And he's there as a young kid in Smicha. While they're there, a person by the name of Bernard Goldenberg walks in. He is the rabbi in Vancouver, and he is helping Vancouver look for another rabbi. He happens to encounter in the Beis Medrash this Smicha student, Marvin Haier, and he introduces himself, and they strike out a conversation. They're looking for a rabbi. Not too many people are interested in going to Vancouver. There's nobody in the Shul on Shabbos. You have 8 or 9 elderly fellow, at most, are full-fledged Shomer Shabbos. It's a Shul that's one of those Shuls that have 500 to 600 families, but you don't know where they are. They're signed up for membership, but they're never there. They only came the Yomim Noraim. This Marvin Haier doesn't know what other prospects he'll have in the horizon. He says, I'd be willing to come out for a Shabbos if you need a rabbi. Rabbi Bernard Goldenberg brings Rabbi Marvin Haier to come for Shabbos, as they brought many kids in for Shabbos. He hit it off right away with that community. They loved him. And right away he hit it off. And the Hashkacha Pratis of this all, of why Vancouver, meaning if he did not, if Rav Yankel Sassel did not like sugar in his tea, or if the janitor did not keep leaving the sugar on a shelf too high for Rav Yankel Sassel, right, Marvin Haier has no reason to be in the Beis Medrash then. Because he's in the Beis Medrash then, Rabbi Bernard Goldberg is there. Because Rabbi Bernard Goldberg there, Rabbi Marvin Haier goes to a community where he could learn his specialty of preaching to the other 99% of Jews who are not religious. Whatever the percentage was at that time in North America. That's where he could learn to connect to those gvirim atsumim, those great wealthy balabatim who have so much to offer but are not being accessed. One of the biggest donors in the community, give me an example, Gordon and Leslie Diamond. They're going to later donate $20 million to Vancouver General Hospital. Major philanthropists. And Rabbi Haier's methodology is not about looking for the grand slam with these balabatim, but to move them to first base, to get some connection to the shul, some connection to Yiddishkeit, some spark. That was the key. That was the key. And it was a Shabbos shul. During the day, there was no daily minyan. Rabbi Haier's visit ends up leaving him Vancouver for 15 and a half years, 1962 to 1977, which means 1961 probably, by the way, was the episode in the Beis Medrash. He talks about those years as being very lonely years, dog day afternoons there in Vancouver. He teaches at the Hillel there on the campuses. They come without kippahs. Rabbi Haier says he's refusing to teach Chumash without kippah. They have a campaign to throw out Rabbi Haier from the Hillel in Vancouver. And the guy who ends up trying to lead the campaign to throw out Rabbi Haier, met him. He's a Belzer Chassid, told me the story. He's a Belzer Chassid now. He's the one who tried to throw out Rabbi Haier from the Hillel for making everyone wear kippahs. And he said that insistence of everyone's got to wear a kippah when you come to the shir was a game changer for the group. Wasn't Rabbi Haier was so strict, but Rabbi Haier thought things of Jewish identity need to be held. In contrast, he had classes for teenagers. He knew their parents were driving them in on Shabbos. Okay, but they're coming to a shir. Let's get them in the door. You understand? So there was that understanding, that give and take of how to work with that community, of how to work in that community. It's interesting, Rabbi Haier mentions that he called Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach for a psak on whether that was permissible or not. And he remembers not getting an answer right away from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. By the way, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is lenient on inviting people for meals who are not observant if you know they're going to drive. So he didn't get an answer from Shlomo Zalman Orbach. But the reason why he tells Rabbi Haier is because later on in Shari Chesed, the one who's going to buy Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's apartment after he leaves this world is going to be one of the non-religious members of Rabbi Haier's shul when she was a teenager. She would go on later on to become religious. Was one of the people that he was Makarev, goes on to live in Shaarei Tzedek. So ironically, Rabbi Haier did get his answer from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach's apartment, but 35 years later. Rabbi Haier realized his kids are getting older and they can't stay there, but he has no offers. No one's offering him the job. So he goes to the Ger Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael, for a bracha, and he writes it on a kfittel. And on it, he puts an idea that he had of something he wanted to do. That year, Rabbi Haier had a sabbatical in Israel. While there, he sees Rabbi Nata Schiller and his method of Or Sameach outreach. He loves that concept down, a yeshiva for post-college individuals or college-age individuals, a yeshiva for them to learn. He writes that down on the kvittel. The Ger Rebbe looks at the kvittel and says, right, and the idea was that he wanted to do it in Los Angeles. It didn't have it. Didn't have an opportunity like this. Los Angeles would be a great place for it. He writes on the kvittel, the Ger Rebbe looks at the kvittel and says, go right away and you'll have tremendous success in Los Angeles. That was Sunday night. That was Sunday night. Tuesday night, there was a wedding back in Vancouver. Mark Belzberg would host one of the Sheva Brachas. Sam Belzberg invites Rabbi Heyer to have gin in his library. And he says, my wife said she saw you at the wedding, and you didn't seem the same. You weren't your same outgoing self. You were very quiet. What's wrong? So, and by the way, just to have the context, Sam Belzberg was a little upset that the kids were all becoming more right-wing, and that was Rabbi Marvin Heyer's doing. He was getting a lot of the people more religious in town, and Sam Belzberg was a little bit uncomfortable with that, but he kept a relationship with Rabbi Marvin Heyer. So he decided that I was going to tell him, Rabbi Heyer says, I got a bracha from the Belzer, from the Ger Rebbe, I might as well tell him my plan straight. If I got a bracha, I don't have to be afraid. I know he's going to think I'm crazy, I'm fanatical, this yeshiva place. And he said, and he says, well, do you know anybody in Los Angeles? And Rabbi Heyer says, no. Belzberg says, the most foolish idea I've ever heard in my life. You're nuts. Terrible business plan. The model's not going to work. Forget the idea. Shelf the thought. But he says, however, if it's haunting you for 30 days, after 30 days you cannot stop thinking about it, some of my best business ideas were the ones that I couldn't sleep over. I kept thinking about it, thinking about it. And Belzberg said to him, if it's lingering on your mind, then it's usually something you're going to be passionate about. So give it 30 days and wait. So he waited 30 days and Rabbi Heyer came back and said, I can't stop thinking about it. So he says, all right, I'm excited by your passion. Sam Belzberg said, I take my tzedakah and where I give it very seriously. I invest in individuals. And he said, I'm going to give you in the near future $500,000 to start your yeshiva in Los Angeles. I think you're nuts. I think it's the wrong business model. But I love that you can't stop thinking about it. And I'm going to give you $500,000 to be able to start it. Rabbi Heyer's own take on that episode, which the family may dispute, is that Mr. Belzberg was deep down very proud about what Rabbi Heyer did for his children. He felt that there was a level of Akaras HaTov that he wanted to pay back, that his kids were, you know, stayed connected and more religious. There is that challenge of the previous generation. They sometimes don't like the direction it's going, but they love the direction it's going. And that's what may have happened here. So Rabbi Heyer says, in that sense, he became a Ger Chassid, as all this really unraveled quickly and very fast. He gets to Los Angeles. He's 37 years old. Rabbi Maurice Lamb, who was then the rabbi of Beth Jacob, says that Rabbi Norman Lamb is going to close down that brief project that I mentioned, that YU brief project in LA, which was called, by the way, West Coast Teachers College. We're going to shut it down. It's riddled with debt. Forget a Baal Tshuva yeshiva. Who needs a Baal Tshuva yeshiva? Go and talk to my brother Norman. Rabbi Norman Lamb and Sheldon Sokol sit down in New York. They say that you're not an Or Sameach guy, Rabbi Heyer. Where are you coming up? You're going to be a Kirov of Or Sameach? That's not your hashkafa. We are the right address. We'll give you the expertise. You find the money. We'll send you the skill. You locate the money. It's a great deal. Rabbi Heyer's excited. They have the initial $500,000 he has from Belzberg, but he can't find any match. He can't find any match. And that was a condition for Rabbi Lamb to commit to allowing Los Angeles to be affiliated in that way. His first check is going to come from Mr. Emil Fish. Emil Fish is going to pay $50,000. That'll be the first check that he is going to receive, in according to Rabbi Marvin Heyer. They're going to use that as the lead money. There's a famous dinner in Century City with Roland Arnall in attendance and helping the fundraising in a famous event. Now, exactly what happened, it is disputed. I asked Rabbi Heyer point blank. He just looked at me and smiled. Someone here try to find out the real story. But according to the legend, Roland Arnall's wife, Sally, locked the door in the back of the building. According to other girsos of the legend, Rabbi Heyer locked the door in the back of the building. Somebody locked the door, or maybe the door was never locked, but it was euphemistically locked. That someone got up and said, we ain't leaving here tonight. So we need to find out if it was authentically locked or not, because I think it adds so much to the story. No one's leaving until we get to 500,000. And that's the beginning of Eula. Right there, that story in Century City with the locked and bolted doors is the beginning of the story of Wayu of Los Angeles. Rambam will more or less dissolve on its own. Rabbi Meiselman comes in 1977, and it's going to stay as a post-high school yeshiva, which again was Rabbi Heyer's concept. Now it's just a YU-flavored post-high school yeshiva. It's going to stay that way for a couple of years, 2 years. Rabbi Meiselman will still be here when Eula as a high school officially begins. He's a great Talmid Chacham, and if you add up the list of Talmid Chachamim who are here in LA, I think he's going to make it into our top 10. Talmid Chachamim in the history of Los Angeles to walk here. A tremendous scholar and academic who has who's a graduate from MIT and a significant Talmud Chacham. How is he related to Rav Soloveitchik? The
nephew?
Okay, nephew of Rav Soloveitchik. He will be here. I mean, where we're standing here right now, literally, there's pictures of Rabbi Meiselman, who was right here in this base medrash. How does the idea of the Wiesenthal Center hit? How does that come up? We got to get to Eula. How does the idea of the Wiesenthal Center come about? So according to the website, and you got to be careful how websites phrase things. They don't always have the full story. In 1977, Rabbi Heyer came to Los Angeles to create the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Incorrect. Rabbi Heyer came to Los Angeles in 1977 because he got the bug in his head to start a post-high school yeshiva like Or Sameach and got a bracha from the Ger Rebbe and the bracha, the backwards bracha from Sam Belsberg, not to build Simon Wiesenthal Center. So someone's got to correct the website. Named in honor of the Nazi hunter, Simon Wiesenthal. It's funny how that's a glaring. I mean, what else are you going to put there? He came not to start it, but it got started. You can't put that on the website. Fine. So the building they initially bought was too big. It simply was too big. That should be every Jewish institution's problem. They bought a building that was too big. Rabbi Heyer was at the La Brea Tar Pits, and a non-Jew asked at the tar pits, they asked the docent while they're on a tour, can those animals come back? And the docent says the woolly mammoth over here can never come back because the climate makes it impossible. On the way home, Rabbi Heyer thinks to himself, someone like Hitler can come back, though. And yet we have no museum to remember a monster like him. The monsters of the tar pits that can never come back, we made a museum for. The monster like Hitler that we need to remember, that we have no museum for. Nothing in America to memorialize the biggest catastrophe. Roland Arnall is taken in the initial leadership, and they cold call Simon Wiesenthal. Why? And Rabbi Heyer is going to take his Balabatim from Vancouver along for the ride. And that's why Belsberg becomes very associated with Eula. I did a prank when I was in Eula, along with Rabbi Heyer. I did a prank on Rabbi. We did a prank on Rabbi Tendler. The prank was that it was going to be Rabbi Heyer was going to be Rabbi Heyer was calling Rabbi Tendler. I was going to play the voice of someone in the Belsberg family, saying that we have a relative who we want to get in the school. Rabbi Tendler starts by saying it's not going to be a problem, but we keep compounding the story and making it worse and worse by saying he's probably not Jewish, never had a real conversion, and we make it, you know, we destroyed it entirely. And Rabbi Tendler is backed into a corner because he's on the phone talking to Rabbi Heyer and Mr. Belsberg, and we played it in front of Rabbi Tendler on Purim in front of Rabbi Heyer. It was a big hit. But what does that have to do with history? Nothing. So now, Roland Arnall, why'd they go after Simon Wiesenthal? He was the most famous survivor at the time. He was a hero. He lived with absolutely no security in Vienna, and because that was the bravado he has. Simon Wiesenthal, when he's approached to be the figurehead of the institution, thought they were nuts. He sends his lawyer, Marty Rosen, to go check and see if this is really a true offer. Is this for real? Is this legit? To say that Simon Wiesenthal cashed in from this enterprise, I want you to know, anybody in the inside of the Wiesenthal Center will tell you he did not receive a single penny until 1984. Why? Because most of the funding that happened for Simon Wiesenthal was a Dutch individual who funded Simon Wiesenthal's causes of hunting for Nazis. That's it. He refused to take any money from the Wiesenthal Center until the Dutch individual passed away. So to use Wiesenthal's name on the building, He was paid zero. He wouldn't take a dollar to put his name on the building. And that needs to be remembered. He was in this lishma entirely. He didn't ask a single dollar. He was a very unique person. His whole nature was for the concept of lo tishkach, not to forget. His wife once said that they didn't warn me when they married him that I'd also be marrying 6 million other people. Because that's what haunted him day and night. He was an architect. He was an architect by trade. And people sent him on wild goose chases all the time. And because of that, he learned the difference between a good tip and a bad tip. Between a good tip and a bad tip. What to know, what's accurate and not. The most important story I could tell you about Simon Wiesenthal himself is the following thought. Even Nazi monsters at some point want to visit their family. Even Nazi monsters at some point want to visit their family. So instead of looking for the Nazis, he looks for their family members. It was an innovative chap. Stop looking for the Nazis. You're not going to find them. Look for the family members of the Nazis, and that's how you find them. And they get a tip in 1953 about Eichmann that he's in Argentina. He has no money to begin this search, Simon Wiesenthal. He gets money from Rav Avram Kalmanovich of the Mir Yeshiva, who gave him money for this, actually. And he sees a report. How does he know to look for Eichmann in Argentina? Because he reads that Eichmann's brother dies in Argentina. Simon is sure that Eichmann is going to show up for his brother's funeral. He goes there and he sees a complete lookalike to the brother. A complete lookalike. Were there twins? What is this? He sends that photo to the Germans. The Germans send it to the Israelis. That photo is going to become the most integral piece to the finding of Eichmann. It's that photo that Simon Wiesenthal, which really gives him the credibility as being the greatest of all the Nazi hunters. So it got so big eventually, this high school concept, the Wiesenthal Center Holocaust Museum concept, that they needed to eliminate the yeshiva dorm. We can no longer house post-college individuals and have a dorm anymore here on the campus. So what happens is at that point, the Balabatim get together and say, why are we paying for a Baal Tshuva yeshiva, yes, of a YU flavor, without a proper high school here in Los Angeles? So you have Jack Slomovic, another individual, one of the important figures here in LA, meet with Sam Belsberg and also Emil Fish and Rabbi Marvin Heyer on Sunday in Beverly Hills to spearhead the campaign. Everybody loves the idea. They know that Rambam is falling apart, and they love the concept. Part of the deal with taking over Rambam is that YU is going to have to, or Rabbi Heyer is going to have to honor all the debts and the pledges that are there with Rambam, which means the beginning years of Yula were tough years to subsume and swallow up that debt for this location, for the concept of Rambam. They need another name on the building. They have Simon Wiesenthal with the Holocaust Museum. Now they want to name the Yula, give the high school a credible identity. They go to meet Menachem Begin to put his name on the yeshiva. In that meeting, and there's great pictures of this meeting, is Sam Belsberg, Emil Fish, Roland Arnall, and William Belsberg. In one of the pictures, you will see David Chappelle in the meeting as well. Spoke to the family, is a funny back history of how he got to the meeting, even though he had no connection to the high school at the time. What happened is, as they're going into the meeting, David Chappelle was walking out of Begin's office. Begin met Chappelle. Why? To get money from him to pay off his own campaign debt, Menachem Begin's campaign debt. Rabbi Heyer quickly recognizes, and Emil Fish pointed this out to me, Rabbi Heyer quickly recognizes the credibility or the capital value that Chappelle is going to have with Begin, because Chappelle is the one who's giving money to pay for Menachem Begin's campaign. Rabbi Heyer puts his arm under Chappelle's arm, swings him around, and walks him back into the room. Chappelle doesn't even understand why he's sitting in the room with Rabbi Heyer and these other guys he knows back from L.A. He knows that Rabbi Heyer pulls him in, and they're sitting in the couch. That is one of the important reasons why Menachem Begin agrees, put my name on this yeshiva, because he's stuck. He needs the money from Chappelle. This must be Chappelle's pet school. Fine, put my name on the building. There's different pictures. It's funny. there is a little interesting sidebar. If you look at the picture of one picture of this meeting, Emil Fish showed me his collection of pictures. Emil Fish is in all the pictures they took. I then found a EULA journal put out in 1988, 10 years in, and Emil Fish is cropped out of the picture. One theory is that they only had a certain amount of room in the journal. That's usually the simplest theory, right? The better theory is that Emil Fish led a campaign that was very opposed to the Holocaust Museum. Why? They thought it would distract Rabbi Heyer's energies from making EULA a successful high school. You're splitting your time and your energies, and your mind is going to be focused on that, and you will leave this high school in the lurch, which was part of your original cause. And so, ironically, he was right in a sense, because Rabbi Heyer's heart and soul is going to be put, and that's going to be part of what would plague EULA for so many years, is to figure out, again, the identity of Rabbi Meiselman's initial piece, Rabbi Heyer's involvement in the school, and then ultimately the beginning as well, Rabbi Shalom Tendler's involvement in the school as well. Rabbi Tendler is brought in as one of the early leaders of the EULA schools. Rabbi Heyer goes on to legend status, really winning 2 Academy Awards. I remember us guys in high school of going into his office just to look at the Oscar sitting there on display. How many times do you get to see a Rosh Yeshiva's office with an Oscar in it once in a lifetime? And we used to love that. Let's talk about EULA in the time we have. EULA is a high school that picks up where Rambam left off. And it's called EULA because it means Yeshiva University of Los Angeles. The deal is this partnership. After a while, Rabbi Heyer realizes we don't need that relationship anymore. The Holocaust Museum is doing its own things. It's own endeavor. There's a legal reason as well. The legal reason as well, it was very controversial to be raising money from the Holocaust Museum and allocating those funds to a yeshiva, and certainly a yeshiva on the East Coast, Yeshiva University. That led to Yeshiva University and EULA agreeing that they're going to need to distance themselves from each other by name. And EULA is then going to officially become YOLA as opposed to EULA, Yeshiva of Los Angeles. But guess what? Nobody likes the name YOLA. And therefore, as much as YU wants to distance itself, it's so careful in the Red Sarachek tournaments in New York, the basketball tournaments, to make sure that the name isn't spelled EULA, it's spelled YOLA. But they realize nobody cares, it's always going to be called EULA. And I think the last couple of years, I believe Red Sarachek stopped caring that EULA was called YOLA anymore, and they left it alone. We'll let it be EULA, because obviously there's no governmental conflict anymore. Now that what? Why did they stop caring? Because now that the Holocaust Center totally separated itself from EULA, there's no longer that conflict of interest. So even though EULA itself is not getting money necessarily from Yeshiva University, or teachers being supplied, and the curriculum is not being supplied by Yeshiva University, there's no conflict of interest as far as the money being raised. Rabbi Heyer is the fundraiser on both. So it's not whether that he would go to Mr. Schwarzenbaum and say, here, we're going to put your money to this exhibit and then put some of it to EULA. It wasn't like that, but it's the same fundraisers. And that's why Rabbi Heyer would come in. Rabbi Heyer would be the program director for the outreach part of the yeshiva here at EULA, or at that initial yeshiva. Rabbi Heyer recognizes that Rabbi May, did I say Rabbi May? I kept saying Rabbi Heyer, right? Did I say Rabbi Heyer just now? I meant Rabbi May. Rabbi May was brought in as the program director for the outreach yeshiva that was here. That's why he was put here. And he ran some successful programs. Rabbi Heyer realized I could use him as well on my fundraising team. And therefore, he could split the roles. One of us will raise for the Holocaust Museum. One of us will raise for the yeshiva. That's one way he tries to create a wedge and keep the integrity of how he's going to fundraise separately between the institutions. Now, around the year 2000, something very interesting happens, and now we get a little controversial. I'll go a few years before. One individual, take 5 more minutes, one individual by the name of Rabbi Meir Pagro shows up here in Los Angeles. He is a fireball here in L.A. for a short period of time. Like, Mozart was that burst of energy, and suddenly, just gone. Rabbi Pagro was the same thing. He came here, and with him came the creation of something called the Advanced Gemara Track at EULA. Rabbi Pagro, very involved in the students' life who were under his watch, so to speak, created a subculture within EULA. And that creates an interesting phenomena which fed into a funny identity for EULA. What is it? Who is it catering to? You look at one end of the Beis Medrash and see these guys walking around with long payas, with tzitzis out, shuckling in their davening, students of Rabbi Pagro, and being graduated to the great Rabbi Nachum Sauer when they're seniors. Needs his own shir, Rabbi Sauer. Talk about the history of Rabbi Sauer here in L.A. And it was creating a funny juxtaposition of multiple worlds under one building, or two different cultures. Now imagine you're one of the guys who's not in the Advanced Gemara track, and you look over at the Advanced Gemara track. What does that say about you as an individual student? It makes you feel like you're not that, and you need to stand out as being not that. And it creates a conflict of interest under the roof of Yula itself. Eventually, Rabbi Pagro would leave, but not without leaving behind a firestorm of controversy in the creation of this advanced Gemara track here at Yula. Okay, by the way, I'm skipping Shalhevet. Why? Because we're going to do a whole segment, I think the next one. When is my one at B'nai David? On the history of left-wing orthodoxy in Los Angeles. We're going to get to that, I think, next week, perhaps. I'll send out the information on Facebook. Check it out. Now, here we got to close the Yula. Rabbi Tendler is trying to balance the different interests, so to speak, whether it's the board, whether it's the likes of Rabbi Pagro, who want a more right-wing institution, left-wing, left, right, and center. Everyone is pulling at Rabbi Tendler each in every way. Then you have the puzzle that is called the Yula Girls School. Also creates an interesting puzzle for Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi May gets involved in the Yula Girls School by bringing in some very influential parents in the Yula Girls School specifically. When you open up the doors to influential leaders in a school, you're also saying, not just we'll take your check, but we'll take your insights as well. And with that comes a brand new set of young parents and leaders who feel that the education at Yula Girls School needs to change entirely. It could move to a whole new level. That leads to a sequence of events which by the year 2000, I think it's 2000, maybe 1999, Rabbi Shalom Tendler, with the agreement of Rabbi Heyer, is just going to stay on at the Yula Boys School full time. What happens is, in a nominal payment, I think it's $1.99 per year, the community buys back the Yula Girls School. The community buys back the Yula Girls School from Rabbi Heyer. Rabbi Heyer will stay on as the Dean Emeritus. Rabbi May will stay on the board for 5 years. That's the agreement. For 5 years, he stays on the board, and each year they will pay $1.99 to be able to keep the community's ownership in the Yula Girls School. That sets a very interesting precedent for the Yula Boys School. And the Yula Boys School is watching that model and looking and saying, wait a second, maybe we could reboot and try something new here at Yula and reassert the modern Orthodox identity at Yula. At some point, Rabbi Tendler says, I'm tired of this conflict of interest, and starts another yeshiva, which is an important segue in the history of Orthodox Judaism in LA, called MBY, which is going to be a very successful institution, leaving Yula in a precarious and funny place. Yula Girls School picks up someone by the name of Rabbi Lieberman. Rabbi Dr. Lieberman is a mechanech for 30 years at the Shulamis High School, a very successful educator who takes on the Yula Girls School and is loved. He is adored. To this day, everyone looks up to Rabbi Dr. Lieberman, and a close friend of mine as well, and really steers the Yula Girls School in a very strong and healthy direction with a strong modern Orthodox hashkafa. Boys School is searching, and it tries a few iterations. Rabbi Glass comes in and brings a new era of Yula. This Beis Medrash is different than the one I was in, and it feels different than the one it's in. It's beginning to carve out a modern Orthodox high school. And under the leadership of some great leaders, David Nagel's here today, they pursue a young individual who is nominated as one of the 36 individuals under 36. 36 people under 36 to watch. The Jewish Week ran a very important annual campaign. 36 people under 36 that to look out for. One of those is an individual by the name of Rabbi Dov Emerson. Rabbi Emerson is pursued as a candidate here for Yula. He has come in and he takes over the helm of Yula. And here I close with the following anecdote, why I think is one of the most pivotal moments in the history of Yula. Please be mochel me that I'm going for it. 3 weeks ago, at a Yula Girls School board meeting, Rabbi Lieberman begins a discussion about the direction and the hashkafa to make sure that everyone is aligned on the board on the same page and we know what we want as far as frumkeit for the school. Now, at this point, Yula Girls' School is its own school, but they do something very interesting. The board members suggest that maybe we should bring Rabbi Emerson to come and present what's the vision for the boys' school, so to understand that we have parallel tracks, at least here in L.A., that while it's not the same leadership in both schools, different leadership, but at least the trains are running in the same direction. Rabbi Emerson mentions his plan, which I'm now coining on this day, called the 36 Points of Light. What is the 36 Points of Light plan? Rabbi Emerson mentions his daring plan that they are going to limit the amount of students they take into EULA. I don't know if the number's 36, 34, I don't know if there is an official number, and I just made it up for the purpose of history, but they are going to be more selective about who comes in. EULA has never done that in its history. It's a daring move, it's a bold move, it could backfire, it could be tremendous. History will tell that story of where the direction EULA is going to go and why that sets off a chain reaction in LA in five different directions. The Shalhevet story next week will now be impacted by that decision. The MBY history, which I will continue in the history of Lakewood in LA, will be impacted by that decision. Valley Torah will be impacted by that decision. The day schools and where they send, like Yeshiva Yavna, will be impacted by that decision. So one little speech, as a suggestion by a board member, come and present to the board meeting about your vision for the boys' school, I think is going to turn out to be one of the most pivotal moments in the history of Orthodox LA, certainly within the context of these 5 years. This board meeting?
Yeah.
The exact night? When was it?
No. What year?
This year. This is 3 weeks ago.
Oh, right,
a month ago. This is history's in the making right now. All right. We stop here for tonight. Shkoyach, everybody.
When is it next week? We know what's not.
When is it?